Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome to Rope Tackle. Tonight, travelling all the way from Oxford University, professor of geography. We welcome Danny Dorling, a frequent commentator on TV and radio, and author of many books, the latest of which is Rule Britannia, Brexit and the End of Empire. Tonight, an authoritative insight and entertaining look at our controversial past, the anxiety-filled present, and the possibility of a fairer future. So, please put your hands together and welcome to the stage, Danny Dorling.
Good evening, and thank you ever so much for turning up. I guess you're partly here not because of me, but because you're a little bit worried. How many people, I can't see you too well, but how many people are a little bit worried about what's going to happen in the next week? Little bit. How many people are a lot worried? Okay. How many people are not worried at all? Okay, one brave soul. Okay. I'm not going to try and increase your anxiety. I am going to take this fairly seriously. It is a very serious subject. I have managed to upset people from both sides of the debate in the last year when I've been doing talks about this around the country. I've upset people who've got a partner who's an EU citizen, who they're worried about what's going to happen to them. I've upset people who don't think I take sovereignty seriously. So believe me, I do. You don't write a book that's as thick as this one, which is outside, by the way, I should say, without thinking it's important. But you do have to laugh at some points about all of this. Otherwise, you'd get utterly miserable. What Sally Tomlinson and I tried to do, we began writing this book about the day after the referendum. And what we tried to do is work out what were the reasons for what was happening. What were the immediate reasons? What were the reasons behind the reasons? What were the reasons behind them? What we hadn't realised, we were actually asked by a publisher to do this, who then published a book by somebody else with a race in the title and dropped us. What we hadn't realised is that there would be about 300 books on Brexit published since the referendum. So there has been one growth industry. As a result of that, we were then turned down by another 20 publishers, and eventually the last one took it. The great advantage of that is that this book, which we began on the 24th of June 2016, has been written, rewritten, written again, and didn't come out until January the 15th, 2019. And January 15th, 2019 was a rather useful date. It was the date of the first, you have to memorise these, it's like the kind of wives of Henry VIII, the first meaningful vote. Okay, what's going on? One take, one best guess. I will try to indicate when I'm guessing, or when I think it's just my opinion. Everybody thinks they're right, but you kind of get to learn to know with Brexit that you cannot always be that right, because you can't predict everything that's happened. So I'll try and tell you when I'm guessing at things, but I will tell you about things that I'm absolutely sure about. And what's interesting about this is there's still a lot about the referendum. We'll get to the present. I will stop talking in less than 40 minutes, so you have to think of questions. Mm-hmm. There's so much about what's happened that we still don't understand, let alone what will happen. When the result came out, almost nobody had predicted it. Many people think they had. Now, if you ask them now, they'll tell you, oh, I knew it was going to happen. And they're not lying. We change stories in our heads. If you ask people now, did you vote? 90% of people would tell you they voted in the referendum. And again, they're not lying. You actually change stories in your heads. What was fascinating about the referendum was it wasn't expected to be like this. David Cameron had waited until a moment when Remain were very popular, before he called it. He wasn't a complete idiot. He had... not a complete idiot, that's what I say. He had been incredibly lucky all his life, if you're trying to understand David. He'd gone to that particular school, which he thought was fortunate. Only one in three of the children from that school would actually go to Oxford and Cambridge. And if you don't go to Oxford and Cambridge from that school, you'd rather let yourself down, your family down, and your school down. So he got into Oxford. And he didn't just get into Oxford, he got onto one of the posh colleges. And he didn't just get into one of the posh colleges, he got allowed to join the Bullingdon Club. And not just that, and that's near the pinnacle of kind of achievement for his set, he got a first class degree, and his friend and enemy Boris Johnson got a 2-1. And you've got to think, he's 21 and things are pretty good. Then he got a girlfriend, he got a job in the City of London, £90,000 a year, first off, because somebody made a phone call. Becomes an MP, young, becomes a remarkably young leader of the Conservative Party. And then takes his party into an election in 2015, and against all the odds, wins an outright majority. The only problem was that he had promised a referendum. He'd promised a referendum, assuming he'd never have to honour the promise, because his Liberal coalition partners would never let him do it. But he was a bit stuck. But if we're going for the reasons behind the reasons, why had he promised a referendum? And the reasons behind the reasons were that his party had been utterly divided on this since Margaret Thatcher resigned, around about 1990. She had managed to keep them under control. The minute she was out, they start stabbing John Major in the back, and the warfare began. You've got to go back and try and work out why, and why for the country. Who knows who this young man is? Go on.
Dominic Cummings.
Dominic Cummings, yes. He's not as important as he thinks he is. But I thought I'd start off. I reordered my slides tonight because I got bored of how I'm doing this. There are only going to be 13 slides. If anybody wants to go to the bar, by the way, apparently it is open as I'm speaking, so don't be put off. Dominic Cummings, right at the centre of the Vote Leave campaign, had successfully been a member of the No for Proportional Representation campaign, had been Michael Gove's SPAD in education, and has been played by Benedict Cumberbatch. So I didn't put up a picture of Benedict. He's no Benedict Cumberbatch, is he? Anyway, it's very hard getting a picture of Dominic Cummings. This was the only one we could get for the books. He does protect his identity. Matthew Elliott, who was the other main proponent of Leave, when we wrote to him, he sent us a signed photograph, which is in the book. Anyway, he likes himself. Dominic was supposed to be heavily involved in the Cambridge Analytica commissioning to fix all of your Facebook so that you would behave differently. One suggestion that Sally and I have is that even if that had an effect, it's unlikely to have had a huge effect, because the biggest bulk of people who voted Leave are not on Facebook. They are old. Not all old people are not on Facebook, but not. So, correlates. What predicted the result? And I'm going to do geographical predictions because I'm a geographer. Here is the strongest prediction of the result. The academic who produced this about 3 weeks after the referendum was absolutely pilloried for doing this, and he shouldn't have done it, and he certainly shouldn't have said why he thought you got this result, but I'll show you the first graph. 0.8 correlation. by far the strongest correlation. We have looked at every correlation over 2 years. I used to be thin, but to be allowed to show this graph, I've actually been eating to get myself just on the border of, I am, on a bad day, I am obese. Anyway, proportion of obese adults in a local authority, as it goes up, reaching a kind of maximum height of about a third, you get a Leave vote of about 70%. Places with 15 to 20%, hardly any leavers. On this side, the more adults who are who have a healthy weight, so high numbers, 50% are healthy, almost nobody votes leave, very few are healthy, heading towards 80%. Now, I've got to show it you because that's the strongest correlation. What the academic, who I will not name, said in the press release, in the LSE blog on this, was it might be because people who are fatter are a bit more feckless and lack control and don't think carefully about the future, but just gorge on crisps and vote leave. Now, he was annoyingly thin. This is not a talk about being fat, but I could do it. We now know, since the Human Genome Project came out in 2010, the strongest correlate to actually getting fat is being in an obesogenic environment and having the genes for being fat. Right? It's nothing to do with being lazy. Those of you who are smug and thin all your lives, it was actually your genes, not yourself. Those of you who are more like me, it is not just my tardiness. If you put me in this environment and there's food, I will eat it. The good news, if you're larger, and this might actually apply to Brexit outcome, we generally do worse, people like me, except when you run out of food. Which is why. Anyway, that's the strongest comment. Why? If the reason isn't the kind of laziness and so on. The best guess, this is a guess, of why you get this incredibly strong relationship is that it's actually reflecting something else. The nerdy thing is it's reflecting how bad Public Health England were at estimating the number of healthy adults. So they actually used other statistics to estimate it, which correlated with leave vote. But, and here's the real clue, the second strongest correlation with vote leave is the number of migrants in an area. 0.79, not 0.8. It's an inverse correlation. The fewer migrants in your area, the more likely you are to vote leave. Why would the migrant correlation and the obesity correlation look so similar? The reason is that migrants tend to be young, tend to be annoyingly fit, well-educated, thin, and healthy. So if you live in parts of the world in which lots of migrants come, particularly from Eastern Europe, but anywhere to be honest, your area will have more thinner people in it. And not only does your area have more thinner people in it, but what then happens is that you start behaving differently because you feel a bit fatter, so you eat less. And this has been shown to be the case. It's called the epidemiology of obesity. Whereas if you live in parts of the country where nobody is coming, nobody is turning up, and you live in the environment we live in today, you all slowly get bigger. So it's nothing to do with fatness, it's all to do with migration. And it's different. Let me show you another correlation that is meaningless. largely meaningless. Okay, it's not out of focus, it is some kind of modern way of drawing graphics, but it makes you think I'm drunk. Here we've got the percentage voting leave on the side. Again, these are local authority districts. We've made them larger if they could take more people. This is Liverpool, Manchester, and this is government's deprivation index. So if your dot is towards me, the area is poor or poorer on average. If you're over that side, Wokingham, St Albans, very low rates of poverty, and leaves going up and down. Now the correlation overall there is 0.03. That's essentially nothing. You might see something going on if you were to take out all these parts of London, Liverpool, Manchester and Birmingham, Cambridge, Oxford. If you were to get rid of those, you could get them all to line up. But it essentially doesn't line up. And what this means is that in a place like Oxford, where I come from, it is the poorer parts of Oxford that voted leave, only about 20%, about 80% was remain. But in somewhere like Cornwall, it's actually the richer parts of Cornwall that voted leave and the poorer parts didn't. The richer parts of Cornwall are where the retirees live, who are older. And right across the country you have those two things going on resulting in overall no correlation with deprivation. So it's not poor people, okay, and it's not fat people. So what is it? It is mainly old people. This red is the proportion who voted Leave. And it's highest amongst the 65 pluses. I should point out, there have been studies now, once you get to about 85 plus, it goes much, much lower. People who can actually really remember the war, who weren't age two in it, they really weren't for Leave. But it's the old who voted out. 18 to 24 year olds, 70% of them were in bed. But they had been in bed since 1991. It's not new. We introduced a thing called the poll tax in 1991. It wasn't deliberately aimed at trying to stop young people voting, but it was amazingly effective. And immediately after 1991, the young stopped voting and stopped registering to vote as well. You start again to register again to vote, but just didn't vote. Of those young people who did vote, most vote remained, but it doesn't matter because so few of them voted. And also they're quite a small group because we don't have that many children anymore. 25 to 34 year olds, majority remain. But the next group, 35 to 44, split half and half. My age group, more leavers. But age above everything else is the biggest predictor. The majority of people who voted Leave were social class A, B or C1. And I'll show you in a little bit that the majority lived in the south of England. And that's not because the south of England has more people. And this is one of the things I think is fascinating. We still have not got over the story that it isn't Sunderland, and it's not Stoke, and it's not Middlesbrough. It's the south. So you've got to ask, why did the old vote out and the young not vote? And then vote to remain. People who wanted to leave were far more likely to vote. Turnout was really, really important. Much more important than we think. People who weren't bothered wanted to remain, sometimes vote to remain, sometimes didn't vote. Partly because all the predictions were towards the end that Remain was going to win. And the spread betting said Remain was going to win. And the spread betting has got each election correct for the last few elections. It had almost put academics out of a job. The spread betting, we could do it now if you've got some money, we won't. I could ask you your opinions about what's going to happen and you'll tell me. Or we could get you each to empty the contents of your wallet out and you have to put that in with your prediction. And you'll think ever so much more carefully about what you do. That's why spread betting tends to be quite good. Something is different amongst those who are older. The argument that me and Sally have come to in this book, and you can kind of guess because the subtitle is Brexit to the End of Empire, was it's that the old grew up in a different time and were told different things. There are lots of things that are very unusual about the UK. Well, equally the fattest nation in Europe, but with Hungary. We have the highest income inequality in all of Europe. The top 10% take 40% of all income. That's an average of six times the income of the bottom 90%. It's only so high because of the top 1%. But anyway, we're incredibly unequal. Back in the 1970s, we were the second most equitable country in Europe to Sweden. You could make an argument for not joining the EEC. You could have actually said, things aren't that bad. We can argue about that later. It wasn't joining Europe that propelled us from being the second most equal country in Europe to by far the most unequal. Because the EU is home to the world's most equitable countries. Finland, Sweden, Norway, the Netherlands, Denmark, Germany. On a global scale, these are the most equal countries in the world. Being a member of the European Union does not make you unequal. You actually do that to yourself. Something else happened. And the other thing, and of course it's more complicated, but you can't just keep on saying it's more complicated forever. The other thing that distinguishes Britain from other countries in Europe is that we had an empire which was bigger than all of their empires put together. We were the home of the largest empire the world has ever known just over 100 years ago. And that affects a place. Think about Rome. The Romans could have pretended to themselves, oh, we're living in a really rich city like Rome because we're really good at inventing things. Look at our aqueducts. Look at this. You know, let's not pretend that the fact that we're controlling the whole of Europe might have something to do with the fact that we can build a Colosseum. In a very similar way, the British, we told ourselves, I was taught at history at school, that we invented everything. We invented the spinning jenny and the first locomotive, and we dug canals before anybody else, forgetting China. And on and on and on. We were really innovative. We were entrepreneurial. I was never taught at school that one reason why this country was so rich is that we imposed the most unfair terms of trade anybody could impose on other people. And when those unfair terms of trade were removed, when the empire and the colonies went, people suddenly stopped buying our overinflated ships. They stopped buying our steel. They stopped buying the goods we made because they were only buying them because they had to. They bought our textiles because we made them. Now, we didn't just make them by our textiles. We picked people up, not just us, the Portuguese and the Spanish, but we picked people up from the coast of Africa. We shipped them to our colonies in America, the 13 colonies. We made them pick cotton. We shipped that cotton all the way over to Manchester. We wove it there. We ship it to India, where we stopped them having their own textile industry, because they did close themselves in India before we came along. And then what do we tell the Indians to do? We tell them to grow opium, which we then ship under Lord Palmerston to China via Hong Kong and destroy the most powerful civilization that was actually competing with us at the time. And that makes you rich. Selling drugs makes you rich. Every Chinese school child knows this. They're all taught about the opium wars. We hardly touch it. And it may well be that this really matters. The image here, who can remember Chris Patton, the Chancellor of my university? You can, yeah. Wiping away his daughter's tears.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the end of Hong Kong, the iconic image of the flag dropping on Hong Kong, and the Royal Yacht Britannia sailing away into the sunset was a young lady crying because it was so sad that the British Empire was coming to an end. And I'm not going to say any more about the empire. This is my favourite empire myth. Our stories about the empire, we just cover it up, what we did. The myth here was that she was crying because of the end of empire. She said why she was crying. It's in a newspaper interview. There's footage of her crying for 3 hours, right? She was about 16 or 17. There's only one reason why a girl of that age cries for 3 hours, right? And he was a very nice young man. And she couldn't understand why her mother and father wouldn't let her stay in Hong Kong, because for God's sake, it was going to be safe, wasn't it? Which it was. You know, I'd have cried. But, you know, that story isn't told. Last advert for the book, just here, and we've got the full photo of the book, is an incredibly gormless looking Prince Charles, with this look of very young, with this look of horror on his face over, oh my God, what do I do? It's a woman. Anyway. Last geographical correlate, and we'll see one. You haven't seen a map like this before. Has anybody seen a map like this before stretched? There's some school-age people in the room. Yes, oh, thank you. A few of you. Okay, I'll explain the map. It's a map of Europe going all the way to Turkey. It's stretched. It's stretched so that everybody gets the same amount of space. So this is Istanbul. If you remember the poster of all those Turkish people who are going to walk in, you know, this kind of almost makes it look that scary, except, of course, they're not allowed. And most of them wouldn't want to. This is Athens, this is Madrid, this is Paris, this is London, we are somewhere down, that's Brighton, tiny blue spot, so we're just there. Scandinavia's up there, but it's very small. because area is proportional to population. So it makes you look at the right places. It stops you looking at mountains and areas where there aren't people. It's coloured by the rate of immigration. So the colour on the map, sorry, I'm standing in front of you people, I move back, because this is the only one that really matters, and then I'll stand in front of you again. The yellow colour, this is where you discover if you're colourblind. That's yellow. You might think it's green, but it's yellow. That means less than 1 in 20 people were born in another country. Data's 2014. So it's just before the referendum. Eastern Europe is yellow. Istanbul and Turkey is yellow. The southern end of Italy is yellow. Lots of people come into the southern end of Italy. They keep on walking, right? You don't stay there. Even though it's where you kind of go on holiday if you're a university vice chancellor, but only for 2 weeks. They keep on walking. All yellow. And most of England and Scotland and Wales is yellow. Because we are a low migration country. That's why we're yellow. Now, I know the papers haven't been telling you this, because the papers don't tend to actually report statistics. But most of the country is yellow because it's on the edge and there aren't many things to go to do there in most of England and Scotland and Wales. The same as there isn't that much if you turn up here. You tend to come from further east. London, particularly West Central London, over 20% of people are born abroad. In many cases, 30-40%, because there are lots of things to do. A third of the midwives of central London are EU, but not UK citizens. Right, 1 in 3 people delivering babies. Why? It's really expensive to live in central London. Because it's exciting. You come for a couple of years, you get paid by the NHS, you deliver babies, hopefully successfully, and then eventually you go, this isn't working, the rent is the same as my NHS pay, and you leave again. But people come there. Most of the country, well, the countries of Wales, England and Scotland, are like Eastern Europe. And it's very different. Just people haven't been told that. Why is the migration rate so much higher here? This is the Netherlands, France, Germany and so on. Because there are no borders. So you live on the Dutch border with Germany and you meet somebody 5 miles that way and you like them and they like you and you get together and you decide to settle down and have a family and you want to live in the same house, one of you is going to be an immigrant. Right? For 40 years, Western Europe has been, this is Switzerland. It's not even in the European Union. But it has those big mountains in the middle, so the population is on the edge, right next to France, Italy or Germany. Incredibly high migration rate. So high migration is common in the mainland of the continent because it is so easy without a sea border. We have this channel, which partly makes it harder, but we are English, which makes it easier. But if you come, you come to where there are jobs. There's one exception.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, there are a few Polish people, not many, and it's in one meatpacking factory in Belfast. But it's not them. It's not them. For speed, I won't ask you to guess who it is, but these are, the blue areas mean that a high proportion of people living in that country were born in another country. No? Ireland. Right, the Republic and the North. In the North, there are lots of people who are born in the Republic, and in the Republic, there are lots of people who are born in the North. And they're normally there because they met somebody on the other side of the border and they got on and they want to live together. Luckily for them, we had an agreement called the Good Friday Agreement where we agreed there is absolutely no border in Ireland. That's what it was. We didn't tell people in England that was, we just said, oh, don't worry, it's something going on in Northern Ireland. It'll be no more troubles, you won't see that on the news. There is no border. And the main reason there is, well, lots of reasons why there is no border, But one of the main reasons is it would be really annoying for these people if there was a border. Not quite as annoying as if you put a wall through the middle of London. But the nearest thing to that, you cannot put a yoghurt pot on that Nun border and get away with it. Let alone have a fantasy of flying drones overhead, monitoring the milk float to send the data to your supercomputer, which will mean you can have a customless whatever ridiculous. There is no border. Really, really isn't. Last area. Anybody guess who the immigrants are here? Yes, it's the British. Largest immigrant. There were quite a lot of immigrant groups on the Mediterranean coast of Spain, but the largest one are the British. Now, depending on events, they kind of dragged it on, maybe to April 12th, although I think Parliament actually has to cancel Friday. By about 11 o'clock British time, because that's midnight Central European time, Friday night. Anyway, if we don't, they won't all come back. Don't worry. The ones who'll come back are the ones who need a hospital. Yeah, that's when they'll come back. So we only get the sick expats. But our hospitals are doing so well that we can easily accommodate thousands of elderly people with sunburn. But we didn't know all this. I'm laughing, but you know, I didn't predict the result. I didn't know things like this before. I drew this map. It appeared in an Atlas of Europe, me and my colleagues did. I had no idea that it might actually matter. Okay, let's zoom on a bit. Here's the actual map of the result. And this is where we go from my opinions to something that does matter. I'm only showing you areas coloured by yellow means majority remain, blue means majority leave. Scotland had a different enemy. The enemy was London, that terrible place which kind of imposes, actually really does impose walls. You know, doesn't let it do what it wants even though it's got its own parliament. Hence Scotland's all yellow. Ireland, just majority remain, but very divided. Wales was actually the average country or region of the whole of the UK. The nearest to voting on the absolute average. But we reported it as, what are the stupid Welsh doing? Don't they know how much EU money they get? Whereas if a journalist had simply looked at the figures, it would have said, why are the Welsh so average? And the answer to why they are, not in Cardiff, not in Ceredigion, the answer why Wales is that blue isn't actually the Welsh. It's people from here, Birmingham, retiring there. Once you take the English retirees, who are the biggest migrant group in the UK, by the way. If you want to have a migrant group to get annoyed about, who don't learn the language, who actually scoff at the language, who really do buy the biggest and best houses, who don't contribute by working because they're retired, who do use the local services, it's the English in Wales. If you're thinking about Wales will be majority remain, and there's London. This map, we can draw a north-south divide here, just north of Birmingham, or we can draw one like that. The majority of leave is south of the line. And if you were to draw the line so you have just under half of the electorate south, and just over half the electorate that way, you've got more Leave voters in the bottom half with fewer electors. And I'm a professor of geography. It really, really annoys me. What happened was the BBC did not have a script. They had a script for talking about a narrow Remain win. And on the night when that didn't begin to happen, they had to make something up without anybody giving them a bit of paper. Sunderland always declares first, it's traditional. And they zoomed in on Sunderland to a woman and two men with less hair than me, of my age, and bang, you have a story. And they kept with that story. And what they didn't say is it was actually the parents of the people who were in that studio in W1A who had been the big bulk of people voting out. There were more Leave voters in Essex than in all these 22 areas that I cannot read out for you. The 22 areas have a bigger electorate than Essex. But many say, oh, Essex is Essex. And the same you could say for Kent. But Hampshire, posh Hampshire, more Leave voters in Hampshire than the combined Leave voters of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland put together. And those seven areas have a bigger electorate. They have more people who could vote, but fewer people voted Leave than in Hampshire. Theresa May should have gone down to Winchester. Okay, Winchester did vote Remain, but it was surrounded by districts in Hampshire that voted Leave. And I can show you for every one of about 26 counties in the south of England, all of them, the same as this. In every case, I can find a different set of areas outside the south of England where fewer people voted Leave, but there were more people who could have voted. Right? This is just, it's marginal, but it is just a majority southern middle class old vote out. And it is important to get that right in terms of what's happening. You know, look at where the Conservative Party represent. This is their thing. Something like 80% of Leave voters were Conservative or UKIP. It really isn't about northern towns. Last few slides. I don't know if anybody had this placard at the latest march, but we're really odd because people wonder about what's going to happen. What's going to happen next? Apparently the army is going to be called up. I don't think we'll need the army to quell any rioting, because we don't riot. The French are most used to rioting. It's very effective. I'll show you in a minute how effective it is. The Germans were the candidates for the most boring people in Europe. But even the Germans are twice as likely to have been on a protest than us. And there are loads of things like this. We think, what can be the reason that we don't protest at all? And it might partly be that we didn't have to. After all, if you were in the home of the largest empire the world has ever known, what did you really have to complain about? We did complain, we had rent strikes and so on, but we built a welfare state in 1945, and we built that partly out of the profits of empire. It was possible to do. This is happening now. We shall see whether it has any effect or not. This is Jacob Rees-Mogg's constituency. But in general, I think it's got the 5.5 million now. But in general, if you look at the map of it, what you're seeing is the map of where people who normally fill in petitions live. It isn't a particularly Remain map. It's just like the map of all other petitions. Right? Bristol West loves petitions. Brighton loves petitions. In general, North East Somerset doesn't. But even then, over 10% a day or so ago had voted out. Last complicated graph, so please think of a question. Again, how we're odd. This is our public spending, almost the same as our taxation. 2002, it was around about 37% GDP. That's like having a 37% tax rate on average. New Labour, it went up, 2003, up 2004, up 2005. That was the not fixing the roof when the sun's shining stuff. It was naughty, I think, because it was actually the extra spending for the Iraq War. No Iraq War, could have stayed like that. Anyway, goes like that, then it zooms up. They all zoom up, because we're in 2008. And you've got an entire banking sector to bail out, which you have to bail out. Ireland came to us to ask for advice over what to do. In particular, they came to George Osborne. And he told them to do this, and bail out every last account, which was fairly disastrous. But since then, they've just lowered the tax rate on Amazon and so on, they're doing okay. Anyway, coalition government comes in 2010, and then we get the start of this. This is austerity. Now remember, GDP is falling. So we're actually getting poorer, and this is the percent of GDP you spend on public services. Down, 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 down. This is IMF figures to here, 2019. That's the end of austerity. You see it goes flat? Actually drew the graph about 4 years ago. So the government had told the IMF it was going to end then. At 36%. Why is this odd? 36% being spent on public services, schools, hospitals, pensions. Because if you were Finland, it would be 56%. And Finland is not a wasteland. Finland's the only part of Europe in which there are not homeless people on the street. There are homeless people in heated public toilets. France, I should say about 54, 55. If you want to have a bed in a hospital, if you want to see a doctor, if you want your children going to a school of roughly the same quality, that's what you have to do. Denmark, Belgium, Austria, Sweden, Italy, Portugal, Norway, Germany, about 44. Germany spends every week a billion more euros on its health services than we do. A billion. If I had been able to afford a bus, I would have sent a bus around with the figure 1050. It's actually 1,050,000,000 euros a week more on healthcare in Germany. Forget 350 million or whether it's a lie or not. If you want a good health service, we need to spend roughly £1 billion a week extra on our health service. That's what you need to do if you don't want the trolleys going all the way out on the Monday morning, which you'll have seen. It's expensive. How do you afford it? You tax people at a normal European rate. It's not rocket science. You also don't build aircraft carriers and send them to the South China Sea. Right, that's not very clever. Germans don't do that. They do build a lot of weapons. They sell them to other people. Netherlands, Greece, Japan, Canada, Spain, and there we are. There. Right, we're odd. We've chosen to be odd. This was a deliberate decision. Jeremy Corbyn's completely irresponsible manifesto of 2017, written by Andrew Fisher, would, and it's utterly terrible, move the 36% to about 38. There to there. That is what you're going to be debating at the next election. Wherever we go from that to that, that's the widest we're kind of willing and able to play in. Because countries are stuck in their particular furrows. If we had been Finland, when the economic crash happened, they increased taxes. So the public services didn't have to drop at all, even as the country became poorer. And not just the economic crash, they lost Nokia. And if you're Finland, Nokia is quite important. It kind of, a company called Apple came along. Has anybody still got a Nokia phone? Oh, well done, you're helping keep the Finnish going. But they still kept going anyway. I just like that picture. Just reminds me to get on with it. We should remember it's him and not Theresa. I have to have a soft spot for Theresa. She did her degree in my department. Okay, almost at the end. Forget the squeals, this is UKIP. What's been going on in this country? European elections, first one was 1979. Proportion of people who voted for the far right in Britain was 0%. National Front didn't put up candidates. 1984, 0%. 1989, National Front put up a few, and it's actually 0.1%. 1994, the referendum party doesn't come till then, it's 1.1%. Jimmy Goldsmith's referendum party arrives, 7.5. 2004, a fifth of people vote UKIP, and begins to rise. 2009, I've added half the Tory vote, and I'll explain in a minute why. 2014, the Conservative Party left the EPP, the main European bloc, before 2014. In 2014, they created a new group to the right of the main Conservative bloc. There's another word to the right of, it's called far right. If you don't believe they created a far right bloc, one of the members of that bloc was Alternative for Deutschland, who are a neo-Nazi German fascist party. Right? Now, By European standards, our Conservative Party from 2014 became a far-right party. We sent in 2014 over 40 MEPs from UKIP and Conservatives who are seen as the European far-right in the Parliament. No other country sends as many far-right MEPs. We are European populism. We are the far-right in Europe. There's kind of one Swedish bloke who turns up and one free Finn, and a couple from Hungary are particularly unpleasant. But we've got to begin to face it. If you wonder why they're not that bothered, think what we've actually been doing. The proportion of people, remember, only a third normally vote in the European election. The proportion of people who voted, in effect, far right, in the last European election was 52.4% by this collection of parties. You could, in hindsight, have kind of seen it coming. We should have seen this. But we didn't. Didn't see it at all. And we didn't see this. This is Labour in May 2015. They're about 33% in the polls. They elect Jeremy Corbyn, they spiral out, they stab each other in the back. Jeremy's useless, he can't do a speech. Really can't. After he did his first 120, he got better at it. Right, down to almost 25% of the vote, February 2017, at which point May's political advisers told her, you have to call a general election. Nobody has ever not improved their position from this. So she calls a general election, and you get this thing, and this thing is the biggest, fastest political swing in the history of voting in Britain. Nothing like it's ever occurred before in so few weeks up there. Not necessarily because they thought he was particularly charismatic. Right? The really fascinating thing about Jeremy Corbyn is he isn't Tony Blair. No cufflinks, no sound bites. I once stood in Parliament Square and watched him begin a speech brilliantly and then watched him ruin it because he carried on and on and on, as I'm in danger of, so to stop. This means that the unpredictable is suddenly possible. And it makes people like me very nervous to say what's going to happen next. And finally, last slide. These are the largest swings that are conventionally measured. Attlee, bumbling man, couldn't speak properly. He gets 10.4% in 1945, but that's over 10 years. Last election being 1935. Let's ignore all the 50s, 60s and 70s, apart from Mr. Foote does spectacularly badly. Neil Kinnock doesn't do badly compared to Foote. Tony Blair, it wasn't really Tony Blair. It was 13 years of Conservative rule, and you get an 8.8 swing in 1997. 18, sorry. But he was very presentable. He goes again to the electorate and he gets minus 2.5. He goes again and he gets minus 5.5, admittedly from a high, you know, but he actually lost votes. Gordon Brown, who, bless him, had the world's biggest financial crash since 1929 to deal with, minus 6.2. Little Ed Miliband, plus 1.4. That's really, really good. The only problem is you have to have about 12 elections like that to actually get into power. And on an election every 5 years, that's, I'm dead. A long time before. And then this, you see what I mean? But the really interesting thing, I'll stop on this over. After the other landslides, Labour got into power. And you always disappoint when you get into power, just naturally. This time they didn't. All they did is force the Conservatives to have to join up with a small party who doesn't even believe in evolution, the DUP don't. And apologies, and I've said that before, people have come after us and said, you know evolution, Danny, it's not real. But the DUP are odd. So Labour haven't won. So they haven't disappointed yet. I know they'll have disappointed a lot of you. And no matter what your politics are, they will have disappointed you at the moment. But you'll forget in 4 weeks or 8 weeks' time. You've forgotten already the most momentous week in British politics that occurred in February, and that most momentous week that occurred in January, and that one in December, and that one in November. We just forget. We move on. What's going to happen? Gone quiet. Currently, the spread betting, which we know is not reliable, puts almost even chances on May's 588-page deal, leaving with no deal, and revoke. Those three are currently on evens. Mine and Sally's long-term view is that this is rather like the Suez Crisis. It's much bigger than the Suez Crisis. The Suez Crisis was deeply, deeply embarrassing, but we actually learned quite a lot from it. And not immediately, but within about 5 or 6 years, things began to get a lot better. And they got better culturally. For a start, the young really did say to the old, particularly the old elite, we don't trust you anymore. And they began to behave in different ways. But also British society changed. If you can remember the trial in which the judge asked the jury, is this a book you would like your wife and servants to read? Yeah. I don't think without Suez he would have had quite the reaction he had, and you'd be able to read Lady Chatterley's Lover. But think about music in the 60s. Think about the 1964 election. Think about the introduction of schools for the first time in British history that everybody could go to the same school. That's what they do on the mainland. Almost all on the mainland, children go to the same schools. And they do much better on average than us. We have a school system which is utterly divided because it was very, very efficient to run an empire. You need public schools to tell young men that they are invincible and they're born to lead other people. And you need a tier just beneath that, the people who know how to take orders but think they're superior to the ones below. And then you all head off knowing your place, a bit like the three Ronnie's, two Ronnie's sketch. And you head off to the Khyber Pass, and the 20 of you can hold it because you all take orders. And it's a brilliant education system for running an empire. The only problem is when you don't have an empire anymore. It's just a divisive, nasty way of carrying on. We're stuck with all these kinds of things. We've got more houses in terms of bedrooms in houses per person than we've ever had. And we've got a generation of young people who've got no chance of ever getting a mortgage. We spend an incredible amount on our schools, but a third of it on schools for just 7% of children. And we worry about school spending, when in other countries in Europe, they spend more on the children who need money spent on the most, not on the ones who need it least. I've mentioned the health service already. We're the only country in Europe with life expectancy falling. And it's falling amongst the English-born, because the immigrants are young, fit, thin, and healthy, well-educated, and disproportionately working in the health service. We are in a particular kind of trouble. Somebody had to be in this kind of trouble. The only place that has left the European community before was Greenland. Greenland spent 3 years negotiating carefully. If you want to know what a good deal is, you can get one. We send, as a whole community, we send €500 a year to help every child in Greenland get an education. They have the right to come here and work because they're also Danish citizens. And in return, we have access to some of their fish because they've got fish. What we've learned over the last summer is that we didn't have the equivalent to what Greenland had. It is crucially embarrassing. It is an education. It is very useful to know that. You've listened to me for far too long. Please go and get a drink, and please think of a question, and thank you ever so much. Thank you. There's a roving mic, which Jeff has got, I think. Yeah. So probably somebody nearer him is more likely to be able to answer the first question. I promise if you keep your questions short, I'll keep my answers short. Which, as you can tell, is hard for me to do.
You say that as a nation we tend not to riot.
Yeah.
You said earlier that as a nation we tend not to take to the streets and riot, but how do you account for the poll tax riots in 1991?
One.
Yeah.
Around about one.
Yes.
Well,
just an anomaly.
Yeah. They're rare compared to writing in other countries that you get. Our riots tended to be short and constrained. Before then, we had the riots, the Brixton riots. And my PhD supervisor, Stan Openshaw, almost got sued because a Sunday newspaper commissioned him to take the 81 census and work out which other parts of the country were most likely to riot the next weekend. And just at the last minute, their lawyers stopped them publishing this because it's incitement to riot. But you can predict the time, which tends to be August, the night, the circumstances. Shooting of a black person is by far the biggest trigger. But we do not riot and loot in the same way that they do elsewhere. The last big riots in London were unusual. They did spread to areas which are not normally, but they were a long time ago now. And people who are pro-leave, I think, are particularly unlikely to riot. It's just partly given the age, partly given the discipline. Partly you've got to say, you know, Nigel Farage's march, I think, has averaged 180 people. And if only 180 people could be bothered to march with Nigel, the idea of them taking to the streets of London isn't high. But put it on the other side. The Remainers, whatever, the million people who marched on Saturday, marching on Saturday is pointless. I mean, I know some of you will, members of my family did. You should really march on Sunday. And then when the march comes to an end, quite a lot of you should sit down. Stay there. Yeah. 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, Monday morning, in the middle of London, on all the streets. That's how you do a protest. So on both sides, I don't mind, I'm getting old and boring. You know, I'm travelling back through London late tonight. You know, I find riots scary. So I'm not objecting to this, but we are not. The 1968 riots. In France, the streets were burning. In London, a few students occupied a couple of rooms at the LSE. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference.
Hi.
Yeah, if you hold it near your mouth, it should be okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks first of all for a really interesting talk. One thing I'm confused about is I'm in that age group, 65 plus. I'm a Remainer. And I'm also somebody who grew up in the 60s, who was in far left groups, who's been on demonstrations all my life, who has protested, who's done all sorts of things. I can't understand why the people who are my age are they all Brexiteers now, according to your graph. These are the people who are the old people who have voted out.
Yes.
And yet we actually grew up in a very revolutionary time, you know, where we were protesting about all sorts of things, the BNP, etc., etc., yeah. The Brixton riots. I just don't quite get why that is.
Okay, well, sort of quick guess at that. You were on one side of that, given what you said. The really interesting thing is that you weren't part of the Lexit Leave campaign. And the fact that, you know, given the left-wing campaigning history and given the referendum in 1975, you should have been part of socialism in one country. We don't want these nasty Europeans, capitalists, controlling us. So we've changed like that. Your generation diverged. It diverged into different ways of behaving and believing. And that divergence was partly by where people lived. So the ones who stayed in the cosmopolitan areas kind of stayed more with those kind of 1960s views. The ones who moved out or retired, who all were up in areas where there was less going on, gradually became more and more conservative in their outlook over time. But also it might depend on the fortunes of grandchildren and children. I don't believe people voted leave selfishly for themselves. I think it was about their worries about their grandchildren and their children. Racism absolutely played a really big part. But there are complicated reasons about why were older people more racist. Sally, I haven't talked about Sally Thomason enough, my co-author, her expertise is school books and curriculum. And in particular, her favourite one is a school book that was used to teach Boris Johnson in his prep school, which used Watermelon Smiles and the word Piccaninny. We didn't come from nowhere in his head. But your generation fractured apart slowly. One thing I find really ironic and quite sad, the biggest rise in deaths in Britain in the last 2 years, but 2015, 16 and 17 and 18, 4 years now, biggest rise in early deaths, are women who've died at aged around about 83 rather than 87. Now to get to 83, you tended to have had to be middle class, because most of the working class died earlier. So they're probably people who actually in 1979, 83 and 87 voted Conservative. But they find themselves aged 83, could be somewhere 20 miles inland from here. And the social worker who used to come in 2010 once a week for 15 minutes to check on them, no longer comes because we've cut half our adult social workers. Meals on Wheels that used to turn up, they had to pay for it, but at least they turned up with food. Most of Meals on Wheels has gone. The rural bus service was cut. And of course you don't drive after a certain time. And I'm pretty sure that the bulk of the people who died early probably actually voted Conservative in their middle age in 1979 and the 80s. But it's a generation that kind of pulled apart. I can go, in terms of elections, the crucial year was October 1974. In October 1974, the south of the country switched and majority voted Conservative. Not enough for them to win, but this was the year before Margaret Thatcher was made leader. And in 74, the South abandoned the North and abandoned the miners, really didn't like the miners because of the 73 strike. Abandoned Scotland, industry begins to go in Scotland very shortly afterwards, 75, 76, 77 in a big way. The South voted to abandon the North then, next election, 79, it wins, the South wins, and if you're in the south of England, you're increasingly likely to be Conservative every year. The country polarised, Conservative areas became more Conservative, Labour areas became more Labour from then onwards. The Conservatives left Scotland, Labour left areas down here, and depending on where you were, you fitted in, because most people fit in. You talk to your friends and neighbours, they go, oh, they are good with savings and good with the economy, you know. And before you know it, given 5 or 10 years of that, you're voting Conservative. On the other hand, living in the North, I lived in Sheffield, and you're middle class and quite posh, but everybody votes Labour. And so you talk to people, and of course you begin to act like that. And so we fit in. We fit into our places and we fit into our times. And you can move a whole population to the right. The whole of this country has moved politically to the right, on and on and on. Jeremy Corbyn's policies are actually to the right of Angela Merkel. He wants a lower tax than they have in Germany. He doesn't want to let in the same number of refugees or anything like them that she's left in. We, as a country, we moved from being the second most equal to Sweden, and one of the most progressive countries in the world by the 70s, to being one of the most right-wing countries of Europe now, the one that wants to leave first. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why did that happen to us? And the answer that we've come up with is because it's a trauma of adjusting to losing the empire. We blamed everything else. We blamed the trade unions, we blamed feminists, we blamed immigration again and again, in the 60s and so on. We blamed Europe. What we never did is say, for 200 years we didn't have to do that much, apart from invading over 170 countries. We could actually be very rich not making the best things in the world. We got out of it shortly in 1986 by having a big bang and liberalising our banks for a bit, but that went wrong in 2008. And the reality is, at some point soon, we're actually going to have to work as hard as people work in other countries, where you can't make people buy the things unless they're better. Mm-hmm. We can't. We had over 2,700 bankers paid over £1 million a year. Yeah. 2,700. The next highest is in Germany, which was 197. You can't have that many bankers paid over £1 million a year unless you really are ripping people off with your banks. And you lose the reputation to do that. Another happy Brexit thing, apart from the bankers in the room over £1 million, bankers' salaries have dropped dramatically the last 2 years. Because no bank is trying to keep their bankers in the country. They're moving their young bankers without children out to Munich and Paris and Frankfurt and Dublin. And wholesale banking is beginning to spread, which is great. When I was young, the highest paid people in the country were doctors. And banking was not just beneath them, it was quite a long way beneath. It was a really boring, mundane job. And we're heading back towards that. Another question? Don't know where Jeff is, though.
Good evening, thank you for a very interesting talk. Just 2 points and 2 possible conclusions. You mentioned the fact that Germany spends £1.05 billion more per week on health. Yeah. Doesn't that reflect in some fact, in some way, that Germany has a population of about 30% more than the UK has, and therefore obviously the spend is going to be higher? Yeah. And shouldn't it be more reflected as a percentage of GDP, as you were talking about? And the other point I would like to sort of put to you is that fiscal pressure, tax rates. I have a lot of experience of Singapore, which has probably got one of the lowest tax rates in the world. It also has probably the best healthcare, social cover imaginable. So would it not be fair to conclude that it's structural inefficiencies in the administration of the countries, especially, I mean, I also have a lot of experience of France, which is probably the one of sort of most inefficient administrative systems in the world. It is incredibly inefficient. And 45%, I believe, of their income on social housing, on social aspects is spent on administering the system and not an actual delivering care. Okay. So the result is, the conclusion is, can you make statistics more or less say what you want them to say?
You can, that's the problem. So the only thing I'm sure about is that this was a majority southern vote. That's the one thing I kind of go to my kind of grave on, because that is really easy to show. It is literally, we know exactly how many people voted Leave, Remain, or didn't vote in each area. So that's the one I'm fairly sure. And with statistics, the only way you know it's not your own personal bias is when you discover something which is the opposite to what you believe the case to be. So you didn't have inside you a little voice saying, oh, go on, find that. And that was when I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for the big northern working class vote out, and I couldn't find it in the numbers. You've got a point about the German figure. And also Germany has a two-tier health system as well. So one reason they can get popular support for spending more on health in Germany is that the middle class actually gets seen a bit faster than the working class, but not in the same way that you can jump queues here. But still, you know, Germany is bang in the middle of Europe for spending. The French are inefficient. You know, they're way up there. And Germany's getting something that's not much worse than France, and France is taxing that much higher. The Finns are really, really efficient. They tax higher than France. But the Finns are spent using their tax money very, very cleverly. So Finland ranks first, second, or third in the world on 102 top social indicators. Right? It's the opposite to us in Europe. But France, yes, is much more inefficient. However, the average French family, the median, is on about 5,000 more euros a year than the median English family. And the average French house is cheaper and of higher quality, even with the inefficiency. Singapore is in the right place. It's geography. So it didn't used to be. We were in the right place. The right place to be after 1492 was on the western coast of this rather backward continent, which until then. Singapore is now in the right place in the world. You can't magically make the UK again be the place to be. And although, there's one last fact about Singapore. Singapore has an 80% state housing system, so it is interesting, but a very dictatorial government. It also has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. Iceland is second, then Finland. But Singapore doesn't get the lowest infant mortality rate in the world just by having a brilliant hospital. But it is a great hospital. I've forgotten the name of it. There are 100,000 Filipino maids in Singapore. 100,000. They used to be pregnancy tested every 6 months. But they're now pregnancy tested every 3 months. And if they're found to be pregnant, they're deported. Now, if we did the same in Britain, if just for English-born people, women, if we pregnancy tested the poorest tenth of young women in Britain every 3 months and deported them to the Falkland Islands, say, if they were pregnant, our infant mortality would look much better. What actually happens is that the Filipino maids either fly back to mum and have the baby there or have an abortion. And the Singapore statistics look really good. The reason I know this is the true story isn't just because it's in the numbers. The Singaporean government never boasts about having the best infant mortality rate in the world. They know that they've got something to hide. The kind of fear you get is in one kind of version of hard Brexit, we would allow in guest workers from other countries because we need people. But those guest workers wouldn't be allowed to have a baby here. A bit like servants couldn't have babies in the past. And how do you ensure they don't have a baby? We'd have to pregnancy test them every 3 months. And that might sound okay to you, but what if one of your children fell in love with a guest worker? And that's why you don't want to head towards that kind of a world. A couple more questions, so more people.
Going back to really where you started, you emphasised empire, and then moved on, and obviously had built it into your thinking. And I've been trying to sort of see what the effect was. I grew up during the war in the 50s, and not terribly conscious of that. So was it just an economic effect, or was there some other mechanism that made us miss it when it's gone?
Okay, yes. Mechanism. There's loads of this in the book, and I haven't done it. We have endless quotes of Johnson quoting Kipling and so on, because it's just too much. And leading Brexiteers who grew up in colonies with black servants, it's seeped into our psyche, the idea of superiority. And you've got to realise how big the idea was. We were, before the height of our empire, at the point that Charles Darwin came along and said there was such a thing, in effect, as the favoured races, which is the subtitle of Origin of Species, and Survival of the Fittest. And the elite of Britain thought that they were the favoured race. That's how else do you explain that you're running the world? William Beveridge wrote a book, Advice for Women, in which he said middle-class women should have 4 children for the good of the race. The idea was that middle-class women had better genes. And for the good of the planet, you should have that. So we have that particular thing that has sort of carried on through. It didn't immediately end. The relationships after India got independence and other countries went in the 50s, we still had relationships. They just withered and withered and withered. Our share of trade with India is now minuscule. We buy quite a lot of stuff from them. We sell them hardly anything because you can make the things we do elsewhere. It's altered, but we just kept on coming back. Every time we found a reason or something that correlates, such as this huge increase in inequality, you've got to explain, well, why was there a huge increase in inequality? Again, what was exceptional about Britain? And we've been accused of arguing for British exceptionalism. But the problem is there is something different. By chance, with 28 countries, at random, you would have expected it to be one of the little ones that left first. Not Germany, France, Spain, Italy, or us. What on earth was one of the largest countries doing, being the leaver? But we, the problem is, and it's like jumping in the back, the worry is you start seeing empire everywhere once you start. When you look at the ages of the buildings and when they were built in particular places. My university, which you'll think of Oxford University as an old and ancient university, it's 800 years old. Well, we do have a little bit of a library which is 800 years old, but 95% of the buildings of my university were built with money raised in the empire. We don't say that, we say Lord so-and-so kindly donated the money for the library. We don't say from the profit he made from his slaves in Barbados. I'm trying to get funding for a studentship, for a student to take every single building in Oxford and put the number of slaves responsible and the labour. Well, we can never pay it back. But just an idea of, it was such a big thing. But it's a legacy, which is completely different. In a country like Germany, where after 1945, you don't have a sense that we kind of had of things. We had a sense of superiority over other racial groups and a sense that we should be the top. So, I'll give you one example. George Osborne in 2015 on TV said, as Chancellor, if Britain follows my economic plan, by 2030, by GDP per head, we will be the richest large country in the world. And what you've got to ask is, why did George Osborne think it was so important for Britain to be number one? Where does that come from? You see it in America, which of course is kind of number one now, and is, you know, kind of took over from our empire. But that take back control, you know, we had control of more of the world than anybody else had. And we take our rightful place where we really should be in the global hierarchy, not cowed by our innovation being controlled by these silly European health and safety regulations, but swashbuckling, you know, financiers riding the high seas again like pirates. Jacob Rees-Mogg's father, his last book written with a colleague, was it William Rees-Mogg, is called Sovereign Wealth, and it's a blueprint for hard Brexit, become really rich by being a treasure island. Forget using the Isle of Man, Jersey and Guernsey, and the Cayman Islands and all the other things. Why not bring it home? You know, and in effect, you know, that's Jacob's view of the future. And it's a view in which a few people become immensely rich, assuming the European Union doesn't just build a wall around us and say, for God's sake, we're not letting you do that. A few people become immensely rich, the mean average income of the country goes up, and most people are the servants of the very rich. But that wouldn't be a bad thing under this view, because if the servants had it within them, we'd give them the opportunity to rise up. But we just see it more and more, that's why we kept on coming back to it. And I'll stop, because I promise not to be long. Who else has got a question?
Hello, Danny.
Hi.
I've got two. Okay. One is, what do you think would happen if we get a second referendum? What's your prediction? And second, how can we galvanise people to be more scared by the rise of the far right?
Okay. I should have said about our monopolies. I think the result we got was perfect, by the way, in hindsight. If it had been the other way around, 52% remain, or even 55 or even 60% remain, we will be looking at the second referendum. The Brexit campaign assumed it wasn't going to win the first time. That's why they had no plan. It's a bit like going into a war, not knowing what you're going to do when you land. If you remember the faces of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove the day after, they were so upset. The idea was that they would be the champions of the people, almost win, Boris would take over and be Prime Minister, you know. And Gove would be his second in command, a bit like Lord of the Rings. With who is that particularly? Yeah, that's Michael Gove. So, what 5248 has done is bring it all to a head. You don't tend to hear, we've got more racist attacks now. But at least, you know, if this had to be the way, we stop blaming it on the immigrants. Given that more people are now leaving from Europe, not from elsewhere, but from Europe, at least it should end that kind of thing. If there is a second referendum, given what I've said, it could go anyway. The one thing we have honestly learned, and I haven't spent my life saying this, I've been really cocksure for the last 30 years about things, the Leavers really, really, really want to leave. It's serious for them. Which again, we wouldn't have known if they hadn't won. We'd never have known about the £8 million from Owen Banks. We wouldn't know about Cambridge Analytica. We wouldn't know just how the ERG, you know, just what limits they would actually go to get what they think should really happen. We wouldn't know what the main tabloids and their owners think. And they will really go for it again. They'll go with Betail, they'll go with Conspiracy of the Elite. Then they'll stoke up the racism, because you can still do that again, and it's the most effective way. So personally, I'm not for a second referendum. I am personally for revoke. I wasn't for the first referendum. I think you either do lots of referendums or you don't do them at all. I'm for revoke on the grounds that we now know the damage that will be done, and we can estimate the number of lives that will be lost. Not just forget damage to the economy, I don't care that much about money. We already know that rising numbers of elderly people are dying and rising numbers of newborn babies are dying. Right? And we know that it's important to have a midwife at the time of birth. And we know that in my county of Oxfordshire we had to close 5 of the 6 midwifery units several times last year. You know, I would revoke purely for the saving and preservation of human life. And you can call it Project Free if you like, but that's serious. And the far right, stop talking about the far right in the rest of Europe. Like Golden Dawn was small and a dropping. The Free Finns are the kind of softest fascists you've ever met in Finland. Finland annoyingly does everything right. It's here. It's our country. It's our beliefs. It's what you hear people talking about foreigners. It's when the language of killing becomes normal, which you see on Guido Fawkes' blog. Frequent death threats. Fascism is being willing to kill people. So it just needs to be said. Clearly, there is a line. We're near to crossing it. And we are the worst country in Europe, according to the statistics of the European Parliament and the parliamentary affiliation of our members of the Parliament. And that it just needs to be said. And that is the division within the Conservative Party. Between old-fashioned one-nation Tories and the ERG. And there wasn't an ERG under Margaret Thatcher. That party has moved far, far, far to the right. She had a tax rate that you wouldn't believe how high it was. She did bring it down. She campaigned to join the European Community. You know, I didn't much like her, but the Conservative Party we have today is not the Conservative Party we had in the 1980s. It's a Conservative Party that was formed by people of my age, who as teenagers, in 1986, 87 and 88, in Oxford, I grew up in Oxford, so I've got a feeling it's kind of personal, because I never liked the university students, in Oxford, as a teenager, they looked at Margaret Thatcher towards the end of her reign and went, I want to join that party. Right? It's a very peculiar set of people for the Boris and Cameron age. Theresa's a little bit older. Theresa grew up 2 miles to the east of me, went to the next door school, lived in the area with the fields of wheat and no black people. If you're trying to... Well, I'm a geographer, not a psychologist. I'm allowed to speculate. If I was a psychologist, I'd be struck off a bit with it. But Theresa, a bit earlier, 1970s, really racist. In Oxford, there used to be a colour bar for the car factory. Black men were not allowed to work on the line. That's the city I grew up in. And if you didn't like black people, you moved 2 miles to the east of the city, to where everybody was white. You've got to think, how did we get this way? And how do you get a population to be angry? Things get worse and worse. Inequalities rise. The two countries with the largest rise in inequality in the 1930s were Germany and Japan. Right. We ought to know now. The nice thing is, you know, the first time round, you can say we didn't know. But as it's already happened in different places, and you have all the signs of what's possible, and we're cleverer, and half the population of women, not men, half of young women go to university. The idea that we are going to let this slip and move further and further into nastiness, I don't think is possible. But I am an optimist. I think we're heading to a new 1960s. Children walking out of school on a Friday because they're worried, not that the world is going to end in 12 years, but if we don't significantly reduce carbon from 12 years from now, we have over 50% chance of getting a 1.5 degree C. And school children know what that means. And most of their grandparents do not know what that means because they're still operating in Fahrenheit. But the best though is, if you really want optimism, 100,000 school children every week in Belgium, in Brussels. And there aren't that many children in Belgium. So there are things happening again, different to the 60s, but the young are becoming energized again. And in a really interesting way, and they're learning the lesson that you can't necessarily trust the old. This happened to my grandfather. He was born in 1916. When he went to the war, he met other men who said, they got the First World War wrong, we know that, it shouldn't have ever happened. And that was inexcusable. But doing it again, so that we have to be out in Germany fighting, because they couldn't in the 30s get things right. And when that generation of young men came back, they voted for something utterly different. Brexit is so much better than the war. You know, it's bad, but we needed something to get us out of this cycle of ever-rising inequality, the rich getting richer, life becoming harder and harder for most people on average, cutting the school budgets, the rent going up, university fees, 1,000, 3,000, 9,000, 15, 20, why not the US? Why not pay £60,000 for the privilege of going to my university? It's not a right, you know. You know how much they charge on the mainland? It's basically zero. All your children can go to Germany, to university, even after Brexit. Germany lets in more overseas students than we do, and charges them nothing. You might think that's stupid. What it means is that their universities are interesting, but also nobody is doing it for the money. Education's a bit like a health service. When people do it for free, they do a really, really good job. The minute somebody is paying me, I start doing an act for them. I give them what they think they want. And I give them a really, really high mark. Really high mark. Amazed how happy a high mark makes somebody. And they go away with a high mark. The only problem is I would never employ them because they can't actually do anything. Right. And that's the problem about treating education as a business. Do you want to do one? Where were you? Should we do one more and then let people hit the bar? We've got one in the front. And this will be the last one, I think. Oh, wait, the mic's just coming. It's just, here we go. It's behind you.
Yes, Britain had something that was different from anywhere on the continent as well. And that is this very anti-European press. I dare say that without the influence of the press for 40 years, we would still be wanting to stay in the EU, although we would always be different.
Yes. Yeah.
How is that possible?
Yeah.
I gave some quotes of the Brexit campaign to a German friend, and they were horrified about the aggressiveness and lies. And typical reaction was, but the press must be objective, more or less, don't they?
Yes.
So how could we have avoided that situation?
How did we get our press into this situation? We didn't join in the same way that other countries joined. I mean, first of all, Six formed an Iron and Steel Union. We asked to join several times, and we were told no. But it wasn't the same kind of joining that when Greece joined, or you know, Spain and Portugal joined, and the end of fascism in those countries, and so on. We joined grudgingly, thinking this will solve our problem. We knew we had a problem. We were dropping down the international ranks. For those who don't believe it, when I first went abroad when I was 15 on a school trip, I could get 10 francs to a pound. 3 francs would buy you a bottle of wine. So a pound would get you free as a 15-year-old schoolboy. Now, if you're older than me, you'll remember that the exchange rate was even higher. And that was the drop. People thought in the 1960s and the 70s that the drop would be arrested if we became part of this larger market in Europe, and we were quite happy to drop New Zealand and Australia and so on for that. But we didn't join because we wanted to be members of something. We joined because we were trying to arrest a fall in our economic position, which was a very big fall. So across the rest of the European Union, you will see European Union flags next to national flags almost everywhere. It's a sign of pride. The other way in which we're different, which might help partly explain our press, because Italy has a bad press as well. It's one other country which has a kind of very corrupt press owned by a few people. We were, I think, the only major EU country that was not invaded or lost to war, and in which the tanks rolled over and back. So we did a bit of twinning of some towns, and we did a bit of sending school children like me to France. But we didn't have a sense of what happens when things go really badly wrong. And we didn't have a sense of why you should get on with your neighbours. We have a tradition that dates right back to Ireland in 1100, of what you do with your neighbours is you walk into their country and take it. We formed the empire when Scotland and England, who'd been fighting each other, formed a marriage of convenience because they noticed that all this gold was going past in Spanish galleons. And they'd be much better off rather than fighting each other, going and taking over part of this new world. It's that different legacy, I think. We didn't join because we wanted to be a member. We joined because we wanted to stop the economic relative decline. But also we wanted to lead and be in charge of it all. Because that's what you do if you're brought up in the top of the British elite system. You know, you're told that you should be telling people what to do and they should be taking orders. The idea of collaboratively getting on with other people and sitting around a room and working out what you can all agree with, it's not the British way. The British way is lead from the top. And it's a way that developed under an empire. It's a Roman way. Whereas other countries don't have this way of behaving, because if they did have an empire, it was tiny, and often they're crucially embarrassed about it. The Belgians are extremely embarrassed about what they did in the Congo. The French know that what they did in Algeria was awful. We're the only people who have an empire who don't seem to have a memory that it was bad. But please do, I'll say the last one, do get a copy for the tidbits. We do go through every single sin of every member of the cabinet. the worst thing they've done, and they made us pay for the lawyers to check it. And the brilliant thing was, because it was all true. Anyway, it's all in there. And please be optimistic. You know, it may feel bad. The Suez crisis felt bad. The war certainly felt bad until Al Alamein. But There's absolutely no reason to think why out of this you don't get something much better. We might even get a European-style voting system where people can actually vote for what they want. We might think that that might be a good idea rather than the system that produces the current 650 people. They've got a chance tomorrow to show us what they can do. You know, I'm optimistic, but, you know, it's like letting the school children run the school for one day. You know, and I'd like to think the school children do a really good job. I've got a horrible feeling they might not. Anyway, thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you.